I'm Paul Jaley, as you know. I'm the director here of American Pilgrimage 400. And it's great. What did you think? How many were at the monument? Awesome, awesome. And there's still more people coming in for that. And you know what? I told my wife, I said, I never saw growing pains growing up because I had no growing pains. I had none of that, but she doesn't think that's very funny. But the thing is that I recognize that I got to know Kirk Cameron from a distance, and then I'll never forget the day, Kirk, that I actually gave your family a tour of the monument years ago, and it's been great. And you've seen him in Fireproof, you've seen him, but most recently, how many have watched any of the American Campfire revivals online? Well, let's not take any further. Come on up, Kirk, and just share with those of you here. Unfortunately, you might have to do this unless you have a loud voice. All their mic stands with the other building.
Oh, mic stands with the other building.
Yeah, that's
could
right.
You just stand here and hold the mic?
Oh, I can do that. Yeah, but I'll just run and do that.
I'm not worthy to untie your sandals.
Oh yeah.
Let alone if you hold my microphone.
So happy to be here with you this morning. Thanks for waking up early. I can't believe my son woke up early and came with me this morning, you know? He's 18. 18-year-olds like to sleep until like 3 p.m., right? Yeah. Stay up so late. But did you have a good time last night? Were you at the monitor? Oh, I did too, and it really is one of my favorite spots on Earth, and these really are some of my favorite people on Earth. Leo, Nancy, Martin, and Paul Jaley, and Marshall Foster. And Jerry Newcomb is here as well. You need to make sure that you know who he is and the books that he's written.
Thanks, bro.
He's one of my favorite people in the world, too. And Bill Federer is also one of my favorite people. And these are the guys and the girls that are, I believe, they're the well from which we are drawing right now to understand the times that we're living in by helping us look back into the past and say, wait a minute, this has happened before. This isn't something new under the sun. This is the way the world works when you kick God out of government, you kick God out of families and out of church. And it's really pretty brilliant. I look at the opposition and the enemy in the world today and I go, wow, like, you gotta high five them in a depressing kind of a way for the relatively small number of them that are able to have such intense hydraulic like power to just pull these levers of government and business and media and even our churches and our seminaries now to reshape culture according to the God that they have made in their image. And their God is themselves, of course. They set themselves up as God. And so I'm really thankful for all of these people and for you, because God always uses nobodies from nowhere with nothing to offer but a fully surrendered heart to Him to change the world. And that's what I want to be. I want to be together with you in His army of compassion to bring Him glory and see the world look a little bit more like heaven during our lifetime.
So I'm going to just swing this around if I can't master this. And I've prepared some remarks today. I'm sorry, I'm just going to take a second here. Prepared some remarks today because there's a concept that I learned, and I hope this is going to be helpful to you. I think one of the things that I struggle with is maintaining a positive outlook in the context of a world that feels so negative. It's moving in such a negative and a downward direction. And so I have to live by faith. We know that. We have to live by faith, not by sight. And it's really difficult. Do you find it difficult, or is it just me? Okay? So how do we do that? And one of the things that Marshall Foster has taught me over the years is that theology and history are important. Now, as a young person, I didn't think either one were important. I was an atheist. I really didn't care about theology. That was just another fairy tale. I thought that Jesus was part of a different trinity when I was a kid. I thought it was, you know, the tooth fairy, the jolly green giant, and God. That was the trinity that Jesus was a part of. But now I'm highly interested in theology because I understand that the way you think about God helps you form your ideas about who you are and informs how you, why you think you're here and how the whole world works. And history is kind of like, you know, this magic seeing glass where you get to look into another time where people tried things with different theologies and you saw the consequences of it. And if we can learn from those things, we can move into the future with great speed and intensity toward heavenizing the earth, if we do it God's way. And so now I'm interested. So the topic that I want to talk about this morning with you, which I think will give you great faith and hope and put gas in your tank and encourage you to have great boldness, is this issue of sovereignty. Let me ask you a question. Who is the ruler of this world? And before you say anything, I just want you to know who's asking you the question. I was in a movie called Left Behind. I play Buck Williams, the investigative journalist who was living in the last days and understood that this Nikolai Carpathia was the Antichrist. And the world is devolving and he's standing on top of a mountain and declaring his sovereignty over all of it. And it seems that his power is moving forward unchecked. And, you know, the nations are converging, you know, they're consolidating power and all of this. Okay? I played the guy in that movie. Many of you have read the Left Behind stories. And you know the Bible. Who is the God of this world? Now, before you, I don't want you to answer out loud. I just want you to kind of sort of think about it. And I want to give you three potential options. And this is highly important. It's not just an answer to a Bible quiz. Who you view as the ruler of this world will impact the way you see the whole rest of life and your purpose here on the earth. Many people choose the option behind door number one, and that's the secular humanist view. Let's just call this the humanist view. Let's not say the secular. Let's just call it the humanist view, and I'm going to make the distinction here in just a minute. And whether this is the Greek or Roman, Russian, or even the American humanist view, it's the concept that the sovereign of the world, the one who rules the world, is man, or even more specifically, corporate man. It's the government. It's the state. They tell us what to do. The government rules in the institutions. The government calls the shots. And this is the view that dominates most public schools, colleges, higher education, the sciences, and into the arts. And it's everywhere. There's another view that I want to share with you, and it's interesting. I think this view is one of the worst views, although not the worst. But if you ask how did we get into the position where people in our world today believe that man is the sovereign of the world and the ruler of the world, I think we have to look to the church that was in the driver's seat with regards to saying that God was in charge of the world, and the church lost its way, and there was a doctrine that made its way into the church that essentially said, no, Satan is the ruler of this world, and Jesus is the absentee king who has the rights and authority to rule the world, but he's temporarily given powers over and subjugated the world to Satan until he returns. So it was like essentially, Jesus is this absentee king. He's concerned exclusively with building and maintaining his church until he returns. And meanwhile, he's preparing a place in heaven for us. So he came, he has all authority, but then he said, I'm going to bounce, I'm going to heaven. In the meantime, we've got Satan in charge of stuff, and things are just going to get worse and worse until I come. And then we have the view behind door number three, which is the secular humanist view. This is even more extreme than that, because they want to say that God doesn't exist at all. And so if God doesn't exist at all, the only supreme authority is an autonomous man. He calls the shots. There is no absolute truth. Morality is whatever he determines it to be. And God is just a figment of your imagination. Which view of the ruler of the world do you hold? Now, I'll just say up front that the Reformers' view, the Biblicist view, the Pilgrim view, was not the humanist view. It wasn't the secular humanist view. It wasn't the view that Satan is the god of this world, even though those who would hold to that view would say, I've got three Bible verses to prove it. You know, I know who the god of this world is, the spirit who works in the hearts of the sons of disobedience, the power of the spirit of the air. But let's just take a look real quick at these views. I want to sort of expand each one of them and show you the consequences of holding each of these views. And I think you'll find this pretty exciting when we get to the end. If you hold the view of the secular humanist, check this out. You ultimately believe that at the top of the food chain is man. You have man who is the god of everything. He's the supreme power. Who does Kim Jong-un think is the ruler of the world? Himself. Right? Who does Nancy Pelosi think is the ruler of the world? Right? Well, who does Anthony Fauci think is the ruler of the world? Right? I mean, there's this wonderful lure to power, and if you can get it, if you know, it's a great job if you can get it. You get to be the ruler of the world. Lots of people have applied and had taken the position for a time, but it usually doesn't work out well when you try to usurp the position of God. So the secular humanist thinks that he's or she is the ruler of the world. There is no absolute transcendent truth in the universe. There's no real absolute morality. All those things are conditional. They're conventional based on what the ruler says is good or evil or true or false. And the strongest dominate in the culture. The guys with the biggest guns or the biggest muscles, they win. It's the survival of the fittest. And the strongest begin to dominate everything in our society. The home, the school, the culture, the church. And the secular humanist believes God doesn't exist. And so that's completely irrelevant. If you believe that view, well then, these are the consequences. If man rules the earth, your commission as a Christian is to choose to do whatever you want with your life, since man is autonomous. There is no plan. There is no higher purpose. You see Christian culture as old-fashioned, irrelevant, and restrictive. If you're a secular humanist, all human activity is guided by human reason and evolution, not ultimate truth or godly principles. Man's just a higher animal in a mysterious universe. I'm getting all this out of Marshall Foster's book, by the way, page 138. You should read it later. And reformation is unnecessary and impossible, since there are no absolute principles to reform to. There is no standard to reform to. What do you mean, heavenize the earth? Well, there is no heaven. There is no God. So we can't, other than the heaven I want to make it. And that may look like socialism. That may look like communism. In fact, it does. It will look like I am God and you all bow down to me. I will be your provider and your protector. Right? That's the secular humanist view. Now, door number two gives us a different option. And this is the worldview of many 20th century Christians today. In fact, I think it's the predominant view in the church. And I hear this from people all the time. When I hear people say things like, I'm like, boy, we need a revival in this world right now, don't we? And they're like, yeah, yeah. But, hey, I see everything falling apart. But they'll say things to me like, but you know, maybe I've read Revelations. Maybe things are not falling apart. Maybe they're falling into place. And someone asked me just the other night, if we try to stop the evil that's going on, are we not just delaying the return of Christ? Doesn't this have to go down this way for Him to return? And therefore, if we try to turn it around and go back, we're just delaying the best thing ever. So what's the implication there? Just let it burn? Let it get worse? I think so. I think that's the implication. Like we'd be fighting against God if we tried to really reform our societies? Wow, there's just something that doesn't sound right about that. If you hold this view where you believe that the world is actually ruled by Satan and he is the God of this world, then you see that not only is Satan controlling the world, but that the state is corrupt, the government is not to be trusted, and they are expected to control the home, the schools, the culture, and the church. And God is only sovereign in the spiritual aspects of the church. So God is contained in the hearts of believers inside the church, and the church is a subculture of the main culture, and we're just getting ready for the end. So if you hold this view, your commission as a Christian is just to concentrate on saving souls from this evil world. You see Christian culture as a counterculture, an isolated, persecuted minority in an evil world controlled by Satan. You see church activity as primary and spiritual, while worldly pursuits are secular and to be dealt with only as a necessity. Like making babies and watching good movies and drinking good beer. All that, that's worldly. That's unnecessary. I gotta go to work, but that's not really what's important. Really? That's not what the early Christians believed. Making babies was sacred, a sacred duty. What we put into, that was part of the cultural commission to make babies and fill the earth and take dominion. And what we put into our eyes and what we listen to with our ears, the media that we consume shapes how we think and develops the hearts and minds of our children. What's more impactful to your kids and your grandkids? Netflix and TikTok videos or their Sunday school class? What's shaping their worldview more? All these things, are they just worldly pursuits and only done as and thought of as necessities? And if you hold this view, reformation is impossible since things are determined to get worse because Satan is in control, don't you know? Things aren't falling apart, they're falling into place. And God is only sovereign in the spiritual aspects of the church. But there's hope. There's still door number three. And door number three is the view of our pilgrim forefathers. Check this out. The worldview of the Reformation in early America saw God as sovereign over men and their property. God was sovereign over all the institutions of the earth, including civil government. They saw that Jesus Christ is the ruler of the earth. They viewed Jesus Christ as the president of the president. So, Joe Biden's not the ruler of the free world. It's the president of the president. The Speaker of the House doesn't call the shots. There is a Speaker of the House of Heaven, they believed, who told the Speaker when she can speak and when she needs to shut her mouth. The CDC is not the ruler of the world. because there is something much higher up than the Center for Disease Control. It's the CTC, the Center for Tyranny Control. And they trump the CDC. Our reformers believed that God ruled the world through His Word, the Bible, which will endure forever. And the Bible was sown into the hearts of self-governing Christians. And when you have a spirit-filled, born-again, self-governing Christian, they are expected to fill the leadership roles and control the home, the church, the culture, schools, and heavenize them all. Godly principles should be infused into all those things so that those institutions are used as tools and servants of the Most High God to bring heaven to earth. Like Jesus said, Lord, may Your will be done. May Your kingdom come and be done on earth as it is in heaven. And we'll get it done through Your Word being the primary animating force in the self-governing Christians who then influence and diffuse Your principles through schools into the hearts and minds of kids and through the family and through all of culture, including movies and food and entertainment and civil government and everything else. In the same way that Satan is using all those institutions to diffuse the fragrance or the stench, I should say, of hell into the world. And the reformers saw Satan as ruling only in the hearts of unbelievers and in the evil world system. See, the reformers didn't see Christianity as the subculture. They saw God is the ruler of the world and Satan is a defeated foe. And it's the hearts of unbelievers that constitutes an evil world system. That's the ghetto. He's the defeated mob boss that lives in the ghetto of darkness, and he's on his way out. And the light is shining brighter and brighter through the lives of self-governing Christians who are bringing heaven to earth. Because they understand that he's the ruler of this world. And he said, okay, wait a minute. How do I reconcile some of these verses, the God of this world? Well, one of my favorite verses is John chapter 12, 31. Paul, how am I doing on time? I haven't been paying attention. I got a little bit more? Okay. So John 12, 31, one of my favorite verses where Jesus said, I want you to listen to this verse. It's awesome. John 12, 31, maybe 32 too. And he says, now is the judgment of this world. Now is the judgment of this world, and now the God of this world will be cast out. And I, if I am lifted up, speaking of the manner in which he would die, I will draw all men to myself. Now think about that. I thought the Bible said God didn't send his son into the world to judge the world, but the world through him might be saved. True, yes. But he's saying, now Jesus has come in fulfillment of the scriptures at just the right time to bring judgment on this world, and the God of this world will be cast down, and he will be lifted up, and he will draw all people to himself. He's talking about, I believe, tell me if you think I'm wrong, a massive power shift in the seat of authority on earth. The God of this world is being judged by Jesus, and that's what happens at the cross. He's defeated. The death blow is given to Satan. His head is crushed. Jesus then rises from the grave, defeats the power of hell and death, and he ascends into heaven, publicly embarrassing the powers of darkness. He receives the keys to the kingdom, and he says, all authority, both in heaven and on earth, has been given to me. And then he gives us the Great Commission. He says, now, go, preach the gospel to every creature. Go into all the world and disciple all nations. Teach all nations everything that I have commanded you. Make them Christian nations. Make it so that all the nations of the earth are filled with the knowledge of the glory of God, just like the waters currently fill the seas. I'm going to be lifted up. The God of this world is cast down. He is defeated. He's slinking off into the lake of fire with a broken head, roaring and accusing, and whatever it is that he can still do as he's bleeding and being drug off the mat. And Jesus is the ruler of this world. That's what our reformers believe. So if you hold the view of the reformers, you see your commission as a Christian today to subdue the earth and build godly nations through evangelizing and discipleship. You will see Christian culture as leavening all areas of life, replenishing the earth, and blessing all mankind. You will see, if God rules the earth, that all of His world and every activity in life is a religious activity, sacred, to be seen as a spiritual work of God. Making babies is filling the cultural commission. You crushing it at work by using godly principles, and I want to just take an example of like Chick-fil-A, or we could name a whole bunch of other great companies, media companies, food companies, tech companies, that are infusing the principles of heaven, and they are winning in the marketplace. And with the profits that they make with that, they're able to not only provide for their families, but do tremendous amounts of good work to bring blessing to others in the world and bring glory to God. Everything is sacred. And reformation in the world is expected if a nation is obedient to God's word. Isn't that what the Bible says? Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord. If we choose to sin, we choose to suffer. But the path of obedience is the path of blessing. If we really drop it in gear and we have the right theology, which is proven by looking at history, and we can see that the people who had that theology built the greatest, freest, most prosperous, generous nation the world has ever known. And we've sent the gospel out to the ends of the earth like no other nation in history. Because covenant keepers win, covenant breakers lose. As Dr. Foster says, you just got to stick around long enough to see the end of the story. And the challenge for us today is that God has written the books of history. It really is His story. And we know that, we know what happened in the beginning of the story, in the Garden of Eden, and we know it that in the end, victory belongs to God. The challenge for us is, we're only, I don't know, somewhere here in the middle, and we may be in one of these nail-biting chapters of the story that is very difficult to live through, but it's what makes it such a page-turner. And God chose to put you and me on page 167 of a much longer story. But the key is, we know the author. He's a great storyteller. He has not fallen asleep. He knows what he's doing. And we get to be in the story. Our job is to play our role well. So let's do that. Let's play our role well, always keeping our eye on the God of heaven, strengthening weak hands and feeble knees, encouraging one another as the day grows brighter and brighter, walking by faith, not by sight, because we know that victory belongs to the Lord. Will you pray with me? Our Father in heaven, You are the ruler of this world. Oh God, I believe that with all of my heart, and I pray that You would show me how to believe that even more. Give me eyes of faith that have 20/20 vision. I want to see so clearly. I want to be able to see Your hand in all of the challenges and the evil that I see going on in this world and in our country. God, as Marshall said last night over dinner, maybe the church appears to be dropping lower and lower in its influence or in its effectiveness or in its prominence in the culture. But maybe we're sinking lower and lower as like we're actually in a slingshot and you're just pulling us back and down so that at just the right moment you just let go and hurls the church filled with spirit-filled Christians, governing themselves according to your principles, high and far into the future, so that your kingdom will be manifested everywhere in the earth. And people will see our good works and our devotion to you and our sincere faith and clear conscience and self-sacrificing love and praise you, our Father in heaven. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
Hello, I'd like to welcome you today. If we could all be seated, please. I do want to remind you that following David Elliott, John Eifel will be here at, in this building. I also want to remind you that the giant culmination will be tomorrow down at the waterfront, and we really encourage all of you to come and be there with us. Okay, my name is Mimi Frank, and it's my pleasure and privilege to introduce to you David Elliott. David's passion is sharing our nation's rich Christian history, both on his tours and with various groups where he speaks. Based in Washington, D.C., his tours bring to life the history of our founding period, his love of the pilgrims, and his desire to let history speak for itself allows him to demonstrate that simple values brought by this most courageous remnant church called Pilgrims has become the fruit of our nation's exceptionalism. Not a we are better than others mentality, but from the standpoint that among the nations of the world, we are unique. Though our nation has done some things wrong, David emphasizes that which we can emulate and hand down to the next generation. Would you please welcome David Elliott?
You know, it's always more fun if we're closer together. In fact, I think that's even scriptural. If we're all spread out, it's easy for the enemy to pick us off. Some of the seats have a number one underneath them. Those are the seats that are going to eject you if you're in there. So if you can conveniently and easily, like in other words, you can walk okay, can you pick up your goods and come this way? The water's better down here anyway. Now, whoever's doing this microphone, can you turn that down a little bit? Yes, no?
You've got to get closer to it. We can't hear you.
Yeah. See, that's why I wanted you down here.
Yeah, that's good. Swallow that mic.
Yes,
can you hear now? Is that good?
Not great. Both are bad.
Is he with you?
I'm just trying to help.
How many of you were at the campfire last night? How many of you sat right in front of the stage like I did? Gee whiz! And Kirk was good about it. The group off to the, as you're facing the stage, group off over here couldn't hear. And so Kirk goes, okay, well let me talk a little louder. And you're right in the front row and holy cow. My daughter got up and left and went to the back to find some peace somewhere. It was truly very loud. So well, I'm delighted you guys are here. The rain is a lot less than the accumulation today is not going to be much at all. If you look at it, it's 0.0 something. So it may be steady, it may be constant all day long, but it's not going to mess, I don't think, anybody up too badly. I love having a microphone I can lick while I talk. All right. Enough about cold microphones. We're going to get started. Talking about the pilgrims today. They came at the wrong time. It was bitter cold. If you think today's cold, it was bitter. The trees and plants had already dropped their summer and fall garb. The grasses and the wildflowers had given up their carpets of color and assumed the winter brown until God calls them forth again in the spring. The trees, now without leaves, opened the sky to the sight and sound of hawking geese flying south, saying, "It's going to get colder. Get out while you can." The babbling brook that ran to water's edge gave them a chill, knowing this is where they were likely to gather their water. The tulips of Holland are now a fading memory, and the vista of New England shoreline demands your focus, as if to say, pay attention. This is where you're going to live, or at least try to. And overlooking the entire scene was one of those winter gray skies, you know the kind, it looks like snow. And now in their shout, they get closer and closer to the shoreline. There it is, that big rock. Sure, that's it. Pull the boat up to that rock. It's a good place to step off onto something firm and solid instead of being on a storm-tossed ship they had called home for more than 9 weeks. To them, it was just a rock, and the pilgrims valued it probably as much as any other rock. But to us, it's Plymouth Rock. From there, they could take their first baby steps in the new world. What lay in front of them was not at all like what they expected. And as it's been said before, never before has so much been required from so few who had so little. From this humble and courageous beginning came a legacy that changed the world. These incredible people with more faith than many before them came to establish a way of life that would cause other nations to stand up and take note. Some nations would be amazed and inquire why and how, while other nations would close their borders and protect their way of life from any such intrusion. Don't let the story come to our country. This is a time in history where religious persecution was front and center in the minds of society because the Reformation had had that kind of an impact on faith. Before they ever left England, this group of English men and women had reasoning among themselves using scriptures as their guide, that they could no longer remain in the Church of England and had to separate themselves from what they thought was hopeless. Without getting into a lot of church history, King James had declared himself to be the head of the church and had the divine right to do whatever he wanted. Wouldn't that be sweet? Setting himself up as God on earth was in direct conflict to what the pilgrims believed. After many years of turmoil, the average citizen was finally able to obtain a Bible and read for themselves exactly what Jesus had taught his followers. They learned that Christ was the head of the church, which put them at odds with the dictates of the day. The king had actually declared himself to have divine rights, which they believe Scripture did not verify, validate, or endorse. On top of this, these people, under the direction of their pastor, John Robinson, had to flee for their lives. They were being hunted down as criminals and imprisoned. Eventually, they were released, even though they wouldn't submit. But by the time the pilgrims decided to move to Holland, it was perhaps the only country in the world where they could raise their families according to their beliefs. Think about that for a minute. Only country in the world where they could find some solitude and some belief. First, they moved to Amsterdam for a year and then went on to Leiden, altogether totaling 12 years. The move was hard, but at least they could worship freely. No more nightly raids or imprisonments. Their numbers continued to grow to almost 300 people. The years spent there were hard as well. They had to learn the new language, find work in textiles and other trades, which they weren't accustomed to. And even their children had to work to survive. They even realized that the long arm of the English king could reach them in the chosen land, even though they were 350 miles away. With these and many other things, including potential war with Spain, pressing in on them, they began to consider other possibilities. Remaining in Holland would not be a long-term solution. The Dutch were good to receive them in their time of need, and even they realized what a remarkable group of people the pilgrims were, for they were hard-working and dependable. But when all was said and done, the pilgrims decided they wanted to raise their children without these present cultural influences and still be English. They desired to retain a measure of their heritage. With this in mind, they lifted their eyes to God and sought direction. Over time, all things seemed to point to the direction of the new world, 3,500 miles away. Looking for a way to make it happen through a series of maneuvers with the help of two of their own, they went back to King James, asking if he would send them to the new world. This he was willing to do in order to, quote, get rid of them in their annoying ways. So in April of 1606, he wrote them a charter, and they made plans to relocate. It was a church plant. Interestingly, the one from whom they were actually fleeing, the king, turned out to be their provision. Think about that for a moment. We don't want you around, and we're going to pay you to leave. With the help of some unethical people, they were able to arrange passing using two ships, the Speedwell and the Mayflower. Speedwell was not speedy, and it was not well. After their first attempt, they discovered the Speedwell was leaking badly. So they sailed back, and after repairs were made, they tried again, but the Speedwell was once again leaking badly, altogether causing a two-month delay. I like what Abraham Lincoln says about this kind of adventure. He says, there is nothing to be learned from the second kick of a mule. How many times do you want to float the Speedwell out and see what happens? With these concerns, they determined that the Speedwell was too risky a venture. Duh. At this point, with some deciding to stay behind, the Mayflower, leaving late in the season with a newly shuffled passenger list, proceeded on alone. I tried to kind of put it into perspective in my own mind. When they land or when they leave, they're a speck, a grain of sand on the ocean. You look down on the satellite image and they don't show. It's just, now think back to what we talked about 5 minutes ago. It was cold. It was the wrong time of the year. The trip across the Atlantic had been brutal, and an uncertain future was ahead of them. Staring at the coastline, you can easily imagine how they felt. What's the first thing you would do? What's the first thing they beleaguered souls did? They got on their knees and prayed, thanking God for a good land and safe passage. And I'm sure most of you, maybe all of you, have seen a movie on the pilgrims, and you see what they went through. I think if you go over to the Mayflower, I think it's about 90 feet long. So there's two times 90, because he said they would have the deck. And so it amounted to about 250 square feet and 102 passengers on 250 square feet, plus the crew. That was crowded. You probably wouldn't even want to sit by him. He's squished against him. The pilgrims came as church and migrated as 24 family units. There's a lot of variations in the numbers, but 15 hired servants, 18 adult women, 29 children ranging from 1 to 17. 70% of the women died in the first year. By the time of harvest, only 4 women were left alive. That's to do all the cooking and all the cleaning and taking care of everybody else. With this in mind from the very beginning, even before they left homes, they had always known and peered down through the centuries. Their mission was always the same: establish and develop this as a Christian land. These people, the pilgrims and the Puritans, made it abundantly clear through their writings that they had come to this land to worship God freely and build a society based on Judeo-Christian principles and biblical teaching. These people were children of the Protestant Reformation. They fled intense persecution. They did not hide their faith. They fully embraced it. They believed that a society could be developed in every area of life by following Scripture. They just needed a place where complete freedom to do that. It could have been anywhere, but with divine inspiration and direction, they chose here. That is why they left everything they held dear and ventured forth across the treacherous sea for 66 days to make it happen. The pilgrims made it perfectly clear after being blown off course 250 miles. And before they ever stepped off the Mayflower, with the compact they signed and the leader they chose, that their intent was to establish order and conduct life by following scriptural principles taught to them by their leader and pastor, John Robinson. Remember, there were two groups of people on board the Mayflower, saints and strangers, and not everyone was a pilgrim believer. But 41 men agreed to sign the compact and to abide by it. Is that not true today? We live under the rules that govern us whether we agree with them or not. On that sea-drenched ship is where self-rule began. There's nothing like it in the world. Before they ever got off, they signed the Mayflower Compact, which actually was the beginning of the American Republic. And to some, it was considered the Pilgrim's Declaration of Independence. This established a civil government promising just and equal laws. By signing this compact, it showed they agreed to be governed by mutual consent. From then on, the compact was repeated to be a preamble to every subsequent edition of their laws for which they dedicated their lives. Much too can be gleaned looking at the leader, William Bradford, who became the governor of Plymouth after John Carver died the first year. Bradford spoke of all of this in his book, of Plymouth Plantation. Well, if you haven't got that one, that's one that, it's a diary. And he wrote down everything. It's a an incredible book. He studied Hebrew, he studied Dutch, he studied Latin and Greek. He liked Greek, Hebrew the most. He was skilled in history, antiquity, philosophy, theology, and said he was a calm and courageous and able leader indeed. Listen to one of the reasons Bradford gave for leaving Holland and going to the New World. Lastly, and which was not the least, a great hope and inward zeal they had of laying some good foundation, or at least to make some way hereunto, for the propagating and advancing the gospel of the kingdom of Christ in those remote part of the world, yea, though they should be but even as stepping stones unto others for the performing of so great a work. You will hear this again as we go through. Bradford is also known, just like Washington, for giving up power and putting it back in the hands of the people. Washington did it after the War for Independence and after two terms as president. Bradford did it also after 1621 Pierce Patton gave him control. The king gave him control and ownership of the colony. And what's he do? He divvies it up amongst the people. So government of the people, not him to dictate. Cannot tell the Pilgrim story without looking at the Puritans in some regards. For the Puritans, the simplest way to explain their vision is with the words of their leader, John Winthrop, in his composition titled A Model of Christian Charity. We are entered into covenant with him for this work. We must be knit together as one man. Basically, it was a covenant with God and one another. The Pilgrims arrived first and were here for 10 years before the Puritans began coming to these shores. For 10 years, the Pilgrims had time to walk out the reason for being here. For 10 years, the Pilgrims had to work at their jobs here. With John Winthrop as their governor, the majority of the Puritans began to arrive on June 8, 1630. Over time, 20,000 came in all, which was referred to as the Great Migration. Winthrop believed they were to build upon what the Pilgrims had started, as well as the work they were called to do. Both the Pilgrims, as well as develop their they called to do, both the Pilgrims and the Puritans believed in the truth they understood from the Bible. But the walking out of it wasn't always easy, and the implementation over time was challenging. Just like those who followed them, the debates at times were difficult, heated, and even separated for a while. But in the end result, clarity. They took biblical concepts and truths and applied them in the real time to real life. They made mistakes along the way, but they learned from them. Are we still doing that today? Let's take a look at some of what two groups of people believed. Does that not ring the bell? Compare the latter founders and leaders. Both the Pilgrims and the Puritans believed that all events in life are governed by providence. Washington had given divine providence credit 67 times for our victory over Great Britain. And most of us in this room, if I said, do you know Jesus Christ? Yeah, I know divine providence. You know who? Divine providence. We probably wouldn't see that as God, as Yahweh, as Jesus. But the Geneva Bible they came over with mentions divine providence 67 times, 145 times, excuse me, 145 times. So if you read that Bible every day, after 145 times, you probably would eventually start to call the man upstairs divine providence. You would never refer to him as man upstairs. But their Bible says divine providence, and Washington saw that clearly. Moving on, they believed that we were all made in the image of God, and if that's true, then all men are created equal. Lincoln said this about the Declaration of Independence. I think the authors of that notable instrument intended to include all men, but they did not mean to declare all men equal in all respects. They did not mean to say all men were equal in color, size, intellect, moral development, or social capacity. They defined with tolerable distinctness in what they did consider all men created equal. Equal in certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This they said, and this they meant. They did not mean to assert the obvious untruth that all were actually enjoying that equality, or yet that they were to confer it immediately upon them. In fact, they had no power to confer such a boon. They meant simply to declare the right so that the enforcement of it might follow as fast as circumstances would permit. They believed that God spoke to each individual first, and then to the king in that order, God, people, king. Personal responsibility is where everything began. Governing oneself in answer to God and proceed from there to a large arena. They also addressed accountability. They believe that government began in the heart of the individual. The more you govern yourself, the less civil government you would need to take action to control you. Benjamin Rush, great signer of the Declaration of Independence, had this to say: if we were to remove the Bible from public schools, we would be wasting so much time punishing crimes and taking so little pains to prevent them. What he's saying, if you don't have crime, you can have limited government. If there's lots of crime, they're making new laws, cops bigger, everything else. They believed that virtue and morality were found in the Bible. That was their moral code. Benjamin Franklin said, only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become corrupt and vicious, they have more need of masters. They believed no one was above the law, biblical law. Do you know that the cry during the Revolutionary War was, no king but Jesus, which became one nation under God? They did not believe in bowing to earthly kings. They believed that religious liberty precedes civil liberty. Listen to what John Adams said. The general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. I will avow that I then believed and now believed that those general principles of Christianity are as eternal and immutable as the existence and attributes of God. And it wasn't just John Adams. Founder after founder, signer after signer said the same thing. They believed the power was in the hands of the people, we the people. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis said, the only title in our democracy superior to that of president is the citizen. You ask a congressman today, they'll flunk that test every time. They're the ones who are doing it. No, they're responsible for us, our title superior to theirs. It's Supreme Court Justice. They believed in equal justice under the law. The farmer or the leader judged the same. No one was above another. So section 1, Article 9, where it says, no title of nobility shall be granted by the United States. Nobody should be calling you a czar. That's a title of nobility. That means you're not entitled to that title. Besides, you're above that as a citizen. They believed if you don't work, you don't eat. Laziness or status was not legitimized. We are a layered society. We are not a layered society like the English counterparts across the sea. You go to Mount Vernon, you'll hear people from around the world going up and asking for directions. Where's Washington's heirs? Where do they live? Where do his heirs live? We don't keep track of that stuff. If Washington had a long lineage, and he doesn't because he didn't have surviving children, didn't have any children to begin with. I'm for doing good to the poor, said Benjamin Franklin, but I think the best way of doing good to the poor is not making them easy in poverty, but leading them or driving them out of it. I observed that the more public provisions were made for the poor, the less they provided for themselves and, of course, became poorer. Yeah. William Bradford, after watching his people suffer hardship under a failed system, dispensed with communal living, which had been set up for them in the charters, which had caused starvation. Instead, he chose a different path for those under his leadership, using everyone's individual gifts, talents, to create a free system of trade that finally broke an end to hunger and grumbling when working for themselves. They believed in the right to own property, pursuit of happiness in our Declaration of Independence. Also, Puritan Reverend Thomas Hooker believed that every man had the right to vote, which became one man, one vote. He also believed in checks and balances. There are other beliefs the Pilgrims built upon, but these alone are a picture for our founding era. We can see the emerging and influence they had on America from their arrival at Plymouth to today. One last thing before moving on. They were strong believers in education. Many who came over from England were highly educated and believed that for their Christian society to develop and be passed on, their children had to be taught the truths of the Bible as well as general knowledge that would benefit society. We're an educated generation. This is great. We're the smartest people in the world. And then you take one of the tests from about 200 years ago, and you can't write anything down. You just have to listen to the problem, and you go, you lost me at the second part of that test. They were incredibly advanced compared to where we are today. And that seems folly to me. I don't quite get it. But In 1642, the Massachusetts General Council Court compelled settlers to teach their children to read and understand biblical principles. That's this state. 5 years later, they passed the Old Deluder Satan Law. How's that for a title? Old Deluder Satan Law. It required when a town reached 50 householders, they were required to appoint a teacher who can teach reading and writing, and when the town reaches 100, they were to start a grammar school. John Adams puts it this way, liberty cannot be preserved without a general knowledge among the people. When talking about history, we sometimes differ in our conclusion because we don't have the full picture. I agree with something, you don't. One of us may be wrong, maybe not, just opinions. But usually we just don't have all the same information. Here's an example of what I mean. A few years back, my lovely wife gave me a book to read. It had several words from the Mayflower Compact. The book is up here. I won't mention the author, but this is his story. So let me read you some of the deleted words and see what you, if you can find the recurring things. You're reading the book, and you get to the Mayflower Compact. This one here. He says, I'll be reading the Mayflower Compact. It's 200 words. So these words are missing. In the name of God, amen. By the grace of God. Having undertaken for the glory of God. An advancement of the Christian faith. Do you think the man has a bone to pick with religion or God? These are examples of words the author doesn't think are necessary to the whole story or important enough to include. He deletes one third of the total document. So you pick up the Mayflower Compact, it goes from this to ain't that. Deleted one third. 66 pages were gone, or 66 words. It's his book. He can decide to do whatever he wants to. He can include what he wants and not worry about it. But when it's a history book, that's a little different. We expect the book to be accurate history. Otherwise, it's just another book of fiction. The bad news is there are probably a few of you here who would know these words are missing. The rest of us, probably no idea, and we miss one of the most important parts of our pilgrim story. Thomas Paine said, "When men yield up the privilege of thinking, the last shadow of liberty quits the horizon." Love that. Depending on what book you read, Hitler said, "What good fortune for governments that people can't think." When men yield up the privilege of thinking, the last shadow of liberty quits the horizon. What good fortune for government that people can't think. I was talking to somebody just as we were coming in about Adolf today. Jamestown was settled along Virginia coast 13 years ahead of Plymouth. Might surprise you, but in Jamestown as well as in Plymouth, the intent was the same. Both charters carried the same message. Wow. When you visit Jamestown, the reason the guides typically give you to explain why the original 104 men and boys came to Jamestown, you ask them why, and their answer is, they came looking for gold. Everyone wants gold. If I saw a piece of gold lying on the carpet or over in the corner or something, I'd race you over there. But the reality is I'm not likely to find gold lying in the street. The original April 1606 charter didn't exactly list the effort to find gold as a top priority. And lastly, my granddaughter can outrun me, so I'm not going to run a foot race. I used to be at a beater, not anymore. If you read the charter, what you find is this. The first two paragraphs list the names of the men and boys who are coming. You say, I want to read the Virginia charter. It's online. It's, pull it up and look at it. The first two paragraphs list the names of everybody who's coming. The third paragraph lists the reason they are coming to Virginia. Let me give you a little spoiler alert. It's not gold. Here's what it is. Propagating of Christian religion to such people as yet live in darkness and miserable ignorance of the true knowledge and worship of God. That's their mission statement. Spreading the gospel. And just so it's clear, the third paragraph talks only about spreading the gospel. And they do it in one sentence, so it's real easy to understand. Then you read the fourth paragraph, the fifth, the sixth, the seventh. You get to the eighth paragraph, and finally on the ninth paragraph, what it says is, I'm winging it here, yo fellas, if you have any time, it'd be really sweet if you could find some gold. That's the ninth paragraph. So when they say they're looking for gold, well, that's not what their own charter said. And that's not what the men, well, everybody wants gold. But that's not what they were doing it for, or at least that's their charter. One other thing they typically don't mention at Jamestown is this. We landed at Jamestown on May 13, 1607. That's true. But the rest of the story is the hidden treasure. Failure to mention it, and it fades into the past. The story is Cape Henry, a speck on the Atlantic coastline, where we first landed 2 weeks earlier. So we show up here, and 2 weeks later we go to Jamestown. A spot on the beach where they erected a cross, where Reverend Hunt dedicated the land to God, and where he thanked God for their safe crossing. You can still visit Cape Henry, although there isn't a lot to see there. But when you stand on the beach and look out over the vast Atlantic, it's pretty obvious you're a long way from home. A concrete cross still stands to honor those men and boys who came to propagating a Christian religion to such people as yet live in darkness and miserable ignorance of the true knowledge and worship of God. That's exactly what William Bradford gave as one of his reasons the pilgrims came to America. You see the sleight of hand there? Unless asked, there will be no mention of Cape Henry, no mention of a cross, and no mention of Reverend Hunt. You don't need to know that. Don't worry about it. This is where we land. This is Jamestown, first English permanent English settlement in the country. Yeah, but didn't they want to do something earlier? We need to move on. Additionally, the pilgrims purchased the land from the Native Americans. They didn't steal it. They also signed a peace treaty that lasted for more than 50 years. As I said before, I don't have to lie to you. I just don't tell you the whole story. That's what they do at Jamestown. They don't lie. Nothing, what they're saying is not wrong, but they just don't tell you the whole story. And you miss what I deem to be one of the most important parts of the story. A few folks arrived and the country grew. God's hand remained upon those people who sought to honor him with their lives and their talents. But as time went on and people poured in from different countries, bringing their various beliefs and cultural differences, it became more difficult for the faith and traditions of the first arrivals to transfer from small towns and villages to large cities. As time rolled by, their core beliefs grew faint. Strife and social changes crept into society. We likely say today, life happens. It would be naive for me to suggest that our ancestors were perfect humans. They weren't. But it appears when they strayed from their principles of their forefathers that God was not far from them and chose to honor the covenant they had made with him. Two great awakenings came when the light began to dim. Two great awakenings came here. These people's hearts were stirred again and the core beliefs of those early arrivals rose to the top as those things of significance that usually do. Quote, I dearly like a French historian, Francois Guizot, asked James Russell Lowell, an attorney, editor, and diplomat. He says, James, how long will the American Republic last? And he replied, as long as the ideas of the men who found it continue dominant. Another award-winning quote from John Adams. Statesmen, my dear sir, may plan and speculate for liberty, but it is religion and morality alone which can establish the principles upon which freedom can securely stand. The only foundation of a free constitution is pure virtue, and if this cannot be inspired into our people in greater measure than they have it today, they may change their rulers and the forms of government, but they will not obtain a lasting liberty. They will only exchange tyrants and tyrannies. Washington said, liberty, when it begins to take root, is a plant of rapid growth. As time went on, it became apparent that God did not forsake or forget those people of the covenant. Like the children learning to walk, God knew they would stumble. Just walk down history lane here briefly from Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield, and the First Great Awakening. If you haven't learned or read anything about Edwards and Whitefield, they're worth spending some time with. They brought the revival and renewed understanding of the forefathers' faith. Edwards is probably most famous for his sinners in the hands of an angry God. People were terrified. People were on their knees, covering their faces. What must we do to be saved? A newspaper called Whitefield the marvel of the age. I'm just letting him borrow that phrase because that's what people call me, the marvel of the age. he preached to more than 18,000 sermons to approximately 10 million hearers, with some crowds as large as 50,000 at a time. And there's a great story about Franklin Chesty. I wonder how far back I can hear him. Okay, we've got about 1,000 people here, and I'm going to step back to the next block. And he steps back, and he can still hear him. He steps back, and he keeps going back, and through his mathematical mind, he puts it together and says he's speaking to about 50,000 people. Whitfield had traveled more than 15,000 miles, excluding 13 trips across the Atlantic. He wore out 4 horses and 2 Mercedes. To Witherspoon, signer of the Declaration of Independence, as president of Princeton, he taught so many of our founders there, it's kind of a who's who list of the founders. A president, a vice president, 3 Supreme Court justices, 13 governors, 20 senators, and 30 congressmen all sat under John Witherspoon. To Noah Webster, who brought a common language to America by studying 26 different languages. You want to speak in one? Which one? I got 26 of them. Over the course of 28 years to give his 1820 American Dictionary of the English language. His dictionary contained 70,000 words. 1 in 6 were new words, and he included more than 6,000 biblical definitions. So if you want the definition of this, he quotes a Bible reference. Webster also wrote his blueback speller. It's up here, and it's one of those little books that's with a lot of those ugly, ugly questions and answers on your math test. Patrick Henry, mouthpiece of the Revolution, the man who asked for liberty or death, who said he was not a Virginian, but an American. He was a candle for starting fires. Benjamin Rush, signer of the Declaration, stayed in Philadelphia to care for the sick when other doctors fled during the yellow epidemic of 1793. African-American leaders Absalom Jones and Richard Allen provided assistance for the physicians against the epidemic. Thomas Jefferson, primary author of the Declaration of Independence. His Louisiana Purchase, his care for the land and its people with specific instructions to Lewis and Clark to treat the Native Americans well. T.J. was responsible, especially interested in the Indian nation on the frontier. He instructed Lewis and Clark again to treat the Native Americans in the most friendly and conciliatory manner. Lewis was to warn any tribes that he stayed with in winter about smallpox, and leave medicine with them for treatment. He also was told to invite the influential chiefs to come and see TJ in Washington and to have them conveyed to his place at public expense. Daniel Webster. Anybody here 200 years ago, he was a guy who came and spoke. The great orator, attorney, and politician of the early 1800s. Charles Finney, another great guy, the second great awakening, brought much-needed course correction and social reforms. Formed the benevolent empire with a budget that rivaled the federal government's budget in 1834. Concerning the kingdom of God, he said every member must work or quit. Was a president at Oberlin College, which was heavily involved with the Underground Railroad. Harriet Beecher Stowe. Probably most of you have heard the name and maybe not read, but you've heard of Uncle Tom's Cabin. Influenced the Civil War. At one point, Lincoln met her and she said, "So you're the little lady who's caused all the stir." It's hard to miss the emphasis of Lincoln as you read the beginning address of Gettysburg. To Eisenhower, who put "under God" in our pledge. And it's a great story, but I'm not going to tell you. You just have to come to Washington, and I'll tell it to you. We put God in our pledge. It's also said, "Under God shall have a new birth of freedom." President Eisenhower also signs "In God We Trust" into law in 1956 to become our national motto. And a lot of people, even after they see "In God We Trust" in the Capitol, still deny it. No. We're not going down that path. It isn't a coincidence. It's been intentional. Generationally, these people are keepers of the covenant. The report from the Congressional House Judiciary Committee in 1854 said, "In this age, there could be no substitute for Christianity." I'd like to hear that today from the House Judiciary Committee. That was the religion of the founders of the Republic, and they expected it to remain the religion of their descendants. Had the people during the Revolution had a suspicion of any attempt to war against Christianity, that revolution would have been strangled in its cradle. How's that for a visual? Our charters of freedom, the Declaration of Independence, U.S. Constitution, and the Bill of Rights don't just magically appear. They had been built upon the words and beliefs of the Pilgrims and the Puritans for generations. This is what T.J. said about the Declaration of Independence. This was the object of the Declaration of Independence, not to find out new principles or new arguments never thought of, not merely to say things which have never been said before, but to place before mankind the common sense of the subject in terms so plain and firm as to command their assent and justify ourselves in the independent stand we compelled to take. It was intended to be an expression of the American mind. And though not a signer, Lincoln, after 85, July 4th, stops in Philadelphia to raise a flag over Independence Hall and had this to say about the Declaration as he made his way to Washington for his first inaugural. I'm filled with deep emotions at finding myself standing here in this place where we're collected together, the wisdom, the patriotism, the devotion to principle from which these institutions under which we now live. In the Declaration of Independence, which gave liberty not alone to the people of this country, but I hope to the world for all future time. It was that which gave promise in due time. The weight would be lifted from the shoulders of all men. This is a sentiment embodied in the Declaration of Independence. Now, my friends, can this country be saved upon that basis? If it can, I will consider myself the happiest man in the world. But if this country cannot be saved without giving up that principle, I was about to say I would rather be assassinated on this spot than surrender it. And 150 miles away and 50 months later, the unthinkable happened. Our founders acted on principles. Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield, and Charles Finney preached it. John Witherspoon, President of Princeton, taught it. Patrick Henry declared it. George Washington fought for it. Thomas Jefferson wrote it to the world. Benjamin Rush practiced it. Lewis and Clark researched and shared it with the Native Americans. Noah Webster's put it into our vocabulary and into our education system. So Harriet Beecher Stowe could write about it and stir the emotions of thousands against slavery. So Abraham Lincoln, in a painful chapter in our history, reminded us of Martin Luther King, dreamed it, its fulfillment. And today we sing about it. Daniel Webster and Calvin Coolidge rededicated it for us in the Daniel Webster in the 1820, December 22nd, said, "Finally, let us not forget the religious character of our origin." So in 1820, we're still talking about Jesus. Our fathers were brought hither by their high veneration for the Christian religion. They journeyed by its light and labored in its hope. They sought to incorporate its principles with the elements of their society and to diffuse it through all their institutions, civil, political, literary. Let us cherish these sentiments and extend this influence still more widely, and in the full conviction that this is the happiest society which partakes in the highest degree of the mild and peaceful spirit of Christianity. Calvin Coolidge, December 21st, 1920. There was among them small trace of vanities of life. They came on deck with orders of nobility. They were not children of fortune, but of tribulation. Persecution, not preference, brought them here. But it was a persecution in which they found a stern satisfaction. They cared little for titles, still less for the goods of this earth, but for an idea they would die. Measured by the standards of men of their time, they were the humble of the earth. Measured by later accomplishments, they were the mighty. In appearance, weak and persecuted, they came, rejected, despised, an insignificant band, in reality, strong and independent, a mighty host of whom the world was not worthy, destined to make free mankind. No captain ever led his forces to such a conquest. Oblivious to rank, yet these men traced their lineage as to a royal house. The message is the same, passed down from generation to generation. The message has become faint or less talked about, but it's still there. How is it that we have become confused as to what has happened to America? Are we not looking again at who we are choosing to follow? Do we look up as our forefathers did to God, or now to man's leadership? Do we want inalienable rights from God, or the shifting precepts designed by man, which would be as changeable as the waves splashing on Plymouth Rock? Does it not behoove us to reconsider what those amazing people gave us by their blood, sweat, and tears? Does it not cause us to pause and reflect on oh so great an inheritance? If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? The answer is, return to the rock from which you were hewn.
Wow.
It's time to look up and back and blow off the dust of our heritage and reconnect America to her Christian founder.
Right.
Walt Whitman. Washington was one of the few men in all of human history who wasn't carried away by power. Washington himself said, few men can resist the highest bidder. When the Continental Congress appointed him as president of the Federal Convention, he opened with, let us raise a standard to which the wise and honest can repair. The event is in the hands of God. The calendar on that day was September 17, 1787, the same day we signed our Constitution, the same day the rest of the globe was spinning at a cool 1,000 miles per hour. For 95% of the world's population, life was hard. And freedom was a mystical word they only had heard about, and in some countries, it's a word best not spoken. On that day, the absolute monarch, Lung Emperor of the Manchu dynasty, reigned over the supreme people, over the people of China, and he ruthlessly squashed any resistance. On that day, our Constitution guaranteed us freedoms unknown by the vast majority of the people around the world. On that day we learned we could dream about life in America, we could dream about the future, but in Japan, the shogun exercised corrupt totalitarian authority over the people. The notion of a voluntary contract among the people wouldn't be heard of and introduced for another 200 years. On that day, while people in foreign nations never knew any better, we were enjoying freedoms like less than 5% of the world that has ever experienced it. It was much the same thing in India, Russia, Austria, Hungary, name your country. When those 55 men at the convention did was unprecedented, unknown to the world, even if we look back to the Greek city-states. The only precedent that was at least similar was established thousands of years before by the tribes of Israel in their covenant with God and each other. And it was that president that guided them in July 1776 when 56 men signed the Declaration of Independence. And in September 1787, when 39 signed the Constitution, the ideas espoused in all documents was a new thing, coming directly from the Pilgrims and the Puritans. Benjamin Rush, another time, I did not believe that the Constitution was the offspring of inspiration, but I am as satisfied that it is as much the work of divine providence as any of the miracles recorded in the Old and New Testament. I'd take that. George Mason, the eyes of the United States are turned upon this assembly. Madison said of the Constitution, declared it as a product of the finger, that almighty hand, which has been so frequently and signally extended to our relief in the critical stages of revolution. How much time?
You're out.
Okay, let me read you one last thing, 2 minutes. They came at the right time. It was the right time all along. It was about the right time because the Pilgrims showed up here in Plymouth. It was the right time because the colony had been growing and the laughter of a child could be heard. It was the right time because they had won the war for independence and Congress was drafting the Constitution for us. It was the right time when President Lincoln pushed the 13th Amendment ending slavery in America. It was the right time when the Civil War ended and it meant Lincoln's wish at Independence Hall came true. But oh, how we wish that hadn't happened. And today, as we glance back at our history, we realize how far we have come. Thank you very much.
We will begin again in 10 minutes with John EISMO will be here in this room at beginning at 11 o'clock. Thank you very much. And another hand for David Elliott. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mimi.